Welcome to Trapping Across America, where fur brothers meet every week. Where we're still allowed to be men, and we're proud to be from the land of the fur and the home of the brave. Welcome to Trapping Across America. I'm your host, Clint Locklear. Today, we're going to cover a variety of different topics. The first thing I thought I would do just to get some humor flowing in the show a little bit is I'm going to read, this is just one of the emails that I get from the anti-people out there that decide that they're going to send me emails and either threaten or try to convince me that taking wildlife for fur and control and stuff like that is pure evil. Now this one comes from Kai, and I don't know why I find this one so entertaining, but it's just more entertaining than a lot of them, even though this isn't as threatening as some of them. I just want to read this to everybody so you can kind of know in the back of your mind how much of a zealot these people are, and then you'll start seeing why they're so dangerous and why logic does not work on them, because what they believe in is close to being a religion. That's exactly what it is to them, a religion. Okay, I'm going to read this. I'm going to quote this. Read it exactly to you. I just wanted to send you a confirmation email, let you know that God has judged you, and you were spending your eternity in hell. I have asked the devil to do me a favor, and you will know when the time comes. You shall see and feel everything you have done to these animals and put this earth in ruin. Your soul will be tormented in a lonely, dark place by banshees and evil. There will be no light for you. You are gone eternally, so be it. Your curse is upon you, so be it, so be it. That is not coming from a sane person to send a stranger a letter saying that God has judged us. Now, seeing a logical debate, which you can't have with these people, apparently she's using God is going to judge me, when at the same time, what did he clothe Adam and Eve in? Animal skins. What did those animal skins come from? Probably from animals, if I'm going to make a logical guess there a little bit. All throughout the Bible, since you use God for a reference point here, hunting and fishing was a very common practice and was never in a negative content. Just something to think about. I wish Kyle would think about a little bit, but she's not going to, because if you try to confuse a liberal with facts, they're just going to go about their business with their hands over their ears. The next thing this basically is saying is that I'm going to hell. And she's asked the devil to come pay me a visit. Whatever she asked him to do, I'm sure it's not in a very nice way. This is a legal way of getting around threatening somebody. And I really don't care. And to me, what that's saying is if you can ask the devil something, that means you're admitting that you're pretty close-knit friends with him. And the other part on here, which I think is more important to us trappers to really get a grasp about when you're talking to the environmental religion we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis sometimes, is she really believes, or he, I'm not sure what Kai is, if it's a guy or a girl, and she thinks that we're the reason that the earth is in ruin. She thinks because we trap animals that all the problems in the world, because she doesn't like what we do, and she can put that off on us, or he, whatever it is. But we're destroying the earth because we're using a natural resource that not only is natural, it reproduces itself. It's healthier when we go out and take the harvest animals. This is one of those places where the organic free-range wild fur farmer comes into place, because it is so true. Now, I bet you Kai, if she wanted to ever have a debate, or he, would probably say we don't need to use animals, we have other methods. Well, when you look at these other methods, what are they? They're synthetic. for one, they don't work as well. And number two, what did they do to get those synthetics? They had to destroy land to build a factory, and they're putting pollution out on a daily basis to give them an environmentally free, animal-free product. Now, if you were to use what God intended for us to use, and that is fur and leather, which reproduces itself, you wouldn't have the environmental problems you would have by using the Green Movement's version of what is environmentally safe. Just wanted to read that to everybody because I don't know why this one just, because it was in such a religious tone. I mean, when I checked my emails that day, I knew it was from Anti because it says, "You guys are going to hell." That's what was in the subject line of the email there. But I just wanted to read that, let you think about that, let you understand these people, besides just being loony as a 13-hour clock, they are religious zealots that do not want to think about religion, but they want to put what they're thinking and their beliefs are in a religious platform like she just did. And then they're going to turn around and all the problems of the world is going to be because of us. Even though we're one of the few groups out there that actually believes in something that's sustainable, which is trafficking. Okay, the next thing I want to do is I want to go into some thoughts on the fur market that I have. That I get to talk to a lot of people, a lot of buyers, a lot of trappers as they're selling their stuff. And one of the things that's come up, our winter this year has been goofy. Everybody that's been out knows it. It's there hasn't been winter in a whole lot of places to just a couple of weeks ago. And what that did is that opened up a lot of people to catch a lot of animals over a long period of time. And that's dumped a lot of furs on the fur market, or it's going to dump a lot of furs on the fur market. Now, the only one that seems to really be getting stressed by the concept of having warm, open, longer seasons right now, if I'm talking to the fur buyers, is raccoon. Your raccoons, the prices you're getting for them right now are not bad at all. I'm hearing a lot of prices of, you know, once you get the good semi-heavies and stuff, you know, $11, $12 green, which is going to put that price anywhere from $14, $16, $17 when they're put up. $17 for a coon, that's not bad at all in my opinion. I wish they were $25 and $30, but they're not. So that gives us kind of a base thing. But what the fur buyers are telling us is they don't know, and all the fur buyers and international fur buyers and the big auction houses are afraid that there was way more coon harvested than the market may want to be able to handle, or the market will take and keep the prices up. So what does that mean to you? Well, it means if you got coon right now, I suggest you get rid of them as soon as you can. This is not the year on raccoon to hold out to the bitter end, because if there is a lot of coon out there and they all hit market and all the buyers are seeing massive amounts of coon, the prices are going to drop. It's just basic supply and demand. So I wouldn't recommend you holding these for a very long time this year, because, you know, if it comes in and a lot of guys didn't trap, even though they bought a lot of supplies this year, it may not hurt it as bad as what they're thinking it's going to, but I have a feeling even if there was guys out there catching small amounts, but over a longer period of time, it can give the market the wrong impression that there's way more coon caught, and they're going to start backing off of what they're going to pay on that stuff. So just try to keep that in mind. Our main topic today is going to be having a mission, an operations plan, and an after-action review. Now this comes from my military background. Everybody in the military is going to understand what this is and why this is so important to you, the trapper. Because as you go from animal to animal, or parts of your season to parts of your season, or beginning next year, or even you can do some of this in an after action review this year, this is a very powerful tool if you put it to use. Now, if you're looking at this from a civilian point of view, you can say, well, this just is planning. And it is, in a form, just planning. But it's more than that, because it's a lot more specific to each one of these three steps. Now, the first one we need to come to terms with is either at the beginning of the season or what we're going to do from week to week in the season, or go from, you know, raccoons early to predators to beaver, however your season's going to go, is you need to set a mission. And, you know, as sexy as that may sound, a mission is basically just setting a goal. And that goal needs to be very specific. I'm going to go raccoon trapping. That's not a very good mission. I'm going to go out and catch as many raccoons as I can in 2 week period. That's still not a very good mission. A good mission is I want to catch 100 raccoons a week, or 5 raccoons a week, or 1,000 raccoons this month. Whatever that mission is needs to be very specific. This is what's different from going out and I'm going to go trapping. This is where a lot of guys get bogged down in a lot of stuff that just doesn't really matter, and it's because they use too general of a plan and they don't have any way to lock that down in so they can actually plan to make their plan work. And the reason the military uses this three-phrase system is because it allows the person or the group or the combat force at that time, it allows them to actually have a plan in place that's very specific to all the needs without leaving stuff out. So if you're going to have a mission, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but I'm going to use this from a military point of view. It needs to be very specific. What exactly do you want to do? Are you wanting to go off the number of traps you're going to run, the number of miles you're going to run, the animals that you're going to try to catch as a goal? Well, however you set that up is perfectly fine, but you need to have that very specific. Now, the next part of this is where it gets a lot more interesting and a lot more specific, and you'll see why you need these three phases to really have a productive platform of goal setting in mind when you're out trapping, is the operations plan. Now, the operations plan basically means, how are you going to plan the operation? How are you going to make this function as you go out and you're going to run your trap line? And what are you going to do when Murphy's Law starts taking over, weather starts changing, things like that? So we're going to use, okay, we want to catch 100 raccoons this month. Someone in Iowa, you may laugh at that, but in parts of the country, that's a hell of a good catch. So you're going to have a mission of 100 coons. You're going to start working on your operations plan. Okay. You need to think, well, how many traps do I need out to have an average of so many coon a day? Which is, I don't have my calculator with me, but you can add that up. Okay. 7 days in a week or 5 days in a week, however you're going to run it, you want 100 coon. How many coons is that? I know about what my catch ratio is, so there I'm going to go, and I need to set this amount of traps. Okay, that's one part of your operations order. Now, what does it take to get those traps ready? And the neat thing about an operations order from the military point of view is when you have that operations plan in place, you don't start it from the summer. You start it from the time of whatever is going to happen is going to happen. So if raccoon season for you starts November 1st to November 14th because you get off from work, that's where you start your operations plan. It starts at November 1st, not in the summer after this first season. And this become very important in a minute why this needs to be this way. So November 1st is going to be the first part of your operations plan, which is the day you're going to start setting traps. Okay, then you're going to work that back. Can you preset or not? Does your state laws allow you to go out and pre-set? Does it allow you to go out and pre-bait? You're going to go back from that even further, and you're going to start having the main trunks of this plan is, okay, I need to go scouting. I need to get my equipment ready. I need to have my bait lined up. I need to have my lure lined up. These are the main trunks of this operation plan. It has to be more specific than that, because when you're talking about where you're going to put your traps, you need to start thinking, if it's a road line and there's tremendous competition, what's plan B on this particular leg of the operations plan? Well, he may want to go to the river. Okay, then what do you have to have set up in place to be able to go to plan B if you're going to go to the river? You need to have your boat ready, registered, maybe some different type waders, different style traps, different style permissions. If you're in an area that you're going to have to go to a canoe, same process. If it's one you need to get permission because everybody's on the road, you know, on November 1st, you need to start. When you start working this plan out and you get to this phase and go, okay, well, A, I'm going to road trap. B, there's too much competition, or for whatever reason, that's not working, so I'm going to go to the river. Is it going to be in a boat? Is it going to be in a canoe? Okay, plan C may be, if all else fails, I'm going to go to private permissions. So somewhere on the back side of this plan, you've got to have set in where you're actually going out and getting permission. And you're setting a timeline up for that to be. Because if I can tell you, if you look at this from a very generic point of view and you go, okay, in the summer, I'm going to go get permissions. You might and you might not. And I guarantee you with that type of plan, you're probably not going to get near as many permissions as you need to. When I was trapping around home here, I blocked off 2 weeks when I was doing a lot of bobcat and coyote trapping and beaver trapping around here for fur. And during those 2 weeks, and I understand with a job you may not be able to do it like this, but you'll get the gist of it because you can do it after work or before work or on the weekends, but you got to have a plan to do it. My job for those 2 weeks wasn't making lure, wasn't working on videos, wasn't working on web content, wasn't working on the yard, it wasn't doing honeydew list. Cindy knew during these 2 weeks, this was permission time. From about 9 in the morning till about 6 at night when most people would start eating dinner. In between there, I'd lay out a map of the area that I wanted to go to. I would go look at them from the road. I would try to find out who owned the property or if they were living there. And I would work on getting in contact with those people. I did that for 2 weeks every year. And what that gave me every single year was way more permission than I can trap, which is what you really want to go for. But just having a plan that over the summer I'm going to get permission, what normally happens is you're going on vacation, you're tired from work. You don't have a plan set in place to go get those permissions. And when you set yourself up on this military goal setting or a mission and a mission statement and an operations plan, you start getting these very detailed things that you can go, okay, this 2 weeks or this 3 weeks or this month or this long weekend, I need to go get permissions. Before I get permissions, I need to be able to get the plot books, or I need to start using Google Maps and lining this out. I need to spend some road time and see what's out there, how their land lays, what's around them, stuff like that. So you have your main trunk of setting a route for your trap, but then you're going to have a B come off of that, which is a leg to this plan that's going to have get permission. Off of that get permission on your paper, you'll write down plat books, Google Maps, GPS, landowners' phone numbers, permission slips, business cards, and everything you can think of. So when you know it during your time that you're going to pick to go get permissions, and you look at your mission statement, it's going to look like an oak tree, basically, because you're going to have one main leg of this is going to be your mission. Off of that, on a time frame, you're going to have these little legs coming off of it. However you want to draw it, it's pretty irrelevant. But you're going to have a main trunk, then you're going to have something like getting permissions. And off of that, you're going to have, okay, I need plat books. And you go, well, where do I get plat books? And you're going to write down, I need to get a hold of the courthouse. Okay, you call the courthouse. How do you get a plat book? Well, you can do it online, or you can get it, you can pay for it, or you can come look at it and borrow it. So then you can go, okay, well, I need to have 2 days if I've got to look at this at the courthouse to go down there and go through all these addresses and match it up with the maps. That way there's no surprises. So if you only have a 4-day weekend or a week to get permissions, you're not burning all your time up running around doing things that you could have planned ahead of for way in advance and known what's coming. Because what you're trying to do with an operations plan is whatever Murphy Law throws at you, you've got a backup plan to back that up. And things are a lot less scary and they go a whole lot smoother that way. Like if you're running this coon line and the river floods out on you, and it's just too dangerous to be on the river, what's plan B? I hope it's not to go sit home and watch Seinfeld on TV. Okay, then I need to start finding some higher elevation and going to the smaller creeks or ponds or dry land coon trapping or going back to some of the places I've pre-baited. But all these in your operations plan needs to be written out on their own little legs, and then those legs are going to have legs coming off of them. And when you put this in this structure, no matter what you come up against, you're going to be able to go, okay, river's flooded. Okay, plan B, I go to higher elevation or I go to road trapping. Okay, there's something's not, they changed the rules on me this year and I can't road trap like they did to us in Tennessee. Okay, what's plan C? I go to permissions. Okay, I've already got that lined out. I've already taken that care of. And then no matter what happens to you, you're still rolling. Now, if you're just planning all year to go road trap or river trapping and you get flooded out, you didn't get your permissions lined up. You don't have your gear set up to road trap. You don't know where the smaller creeks are that don't flood as quick. All these things start just beating on you throughout the season, and your production goes down and down and down and down. And then all of a sudden it's just like, well, forget this. I'm going to go try something else. But you didn't plan for that something else either. Because part of this operations plan, well, if you show up and you're going to raccoon trap and distemper went through there, what's your plan B? Besides just thinking, well, then I'll go try to catch some coyotes. Well, then for that major plan B for a complete animal shift, what have you got laid out to do that? That's where this becomes important. And the more you plan, there's a lot of neat things that starts happening. You start going, okay, the problem can be this. Well, that's okay. I've got the answer. It's this. The river's flooding. I go to the road. Road's not working. I go to the river. That's not working. I go to permissions. I go to dairy farms. Whatever it is that you've got lined out, no matter what's thrown at you, you've got a way to handle that. And if this isn't making sense to you, I'm going to put this back in the military point of view thing. When we would go do a mission, if we were going to raid a building, for example, and okay, we knew we were going to do that at 2100, so that's when the attack was going to happen at 2100, i.e. the coon season starts November 1st. We know that because we've given the mission that we're going to raid this building. Okay, then we're going to actually have a raid plan in place. Who's going to have support cover fire? Who's going to be raiding? Who's going to be doing security? What happens if three people get shot? What happens if the helicopter can't get us to the LZ? What are we going to do if they can't get us out of the LZ? What are we going to do if it's a larger force than we thought it was? What are we going to do if there's no one there? And you just run this through your mind, and it's planning. It's planning. It's planning. So if you're in this raiding party and you work this backwards from the time you get your mission, from the time the mission's supposed to happen, and you're going out through the woods, you've already got your route laid out. You've got additional routes laid out. You've got different transportations laid in. If the helicopter can't do it, then you need to have a truck on hand. If that doesn't work and you need to road march to your objective, what routes are you going to take? So you need to have all that lined out. If there's anything goes on in that mission in between there, someone gets hurt, someone gets sick, you get ambushed, where your rally point's at, all that type stuff is laid out in here. The hardest part about any mission of the military is the planning of it, because you're going to sit there and all the hard work is done before you go out and pull the mission. And if you look at your trapping in the same way, things start happening very, very easily to you. Now, when you go out and you trap, you need to be realistic with what's going on around you as you're out in the field. Because the last part of a military operation as far as planning goes is an after-action review. Now, if you had a partner, this is a whole lot easier, because if you're the one by yourself doing something, you're probably going to lie to yourself pretty good, and you're going to allow things to go Well, it was raining too much, and I thought I'd be able to do this, but it didn't work out. The animals weren't moving, and yada, yada, yada. You know how that is when you're by yourself. You can kind of be gentler to yourself. If you've got a partner, you can go out and, okay, well, that turned out great. Why did it turn out great? And you have this action review. Or, man, that sucked. What could we have done to make that better? And y'all sit down together over a cup of coffee at a diner somewhere and go, well, you know, the DP traps didn't do what we thought we've done. We should have had more snares and conibears and footholds lined out. Or for some reason, the coons were refusing all these conibears. How can we adjust that next time? The part of the action after action review is the most important part for getting better in your trapping, but you've got to be honest with what you're telling yourself. If you try to be egotistical about it, and you try to blame everything around you but yourself, it doesn't work out that way. Now, see, in the military, the smallest unit you're probably ever going to be with is going to be a squad. So you've got you got two team leaders, you've got a squad leader, you've got anybody in the middle of there, and there's no way to hide when something goes wrong on a mission or something wasn't planned ahead. But the beauty of the after-action review is when something, and that's the whole purpose of training, and that's the whole purpose of going from season to season as you get better and better, at least I hope it is for you, is in the military, when you go out and you practice doing a raid, and your helicopter can't get you out of the LZ, and you didn't think about that, well then, you know, everybody that just had to walk 33 miles back to the base is going to go, we need to have a better plan how to get out of there once this is over with. Well, yeah. So next time you're going to make a raid plan, you can better believe you're going to be thinking, okay, if the helicopter can't come get us, what are we going to do? You know, it'd be a lot nicer to have some deuce and a halfs or Humvees come get us than walk. Or we need to give ourselves a little more time to walk so we don't kill ourselves getting back. So when you plan the next time, that's going to be there. So if you're relying on one thing to work on your trap line and it doesn't work the way you want it to, really put some thought into that. Because next year, next season, next week, whatever it's going to be, you're not going to make that mistake. But if you don't consciously think about it and be honest with yourself, you'll make the same mistake after the same mistake after the same mistake. And maybe 10, 15 years down the road, you'll go, well, you know, maybe I ought to try this. But if you use the after action review section of this, you can catch that really, really quick. Because when you put your operations plan in motion, you're going to see you didn't think of everything. And when you didn't think about something, you know, just have a notebook in there and go, well, I really, you know, screwed the pooch on this one. I should have had more bait ready. Well, when you're going through your action after action review, look at your notes, should have had more bait ready. So next year when you're making this operations plan, you're going to have more bait ready. And it's just going to get smoother and smoother. And the more that that happens, the more often you're going to have better results when you're out trapping. If you go to this military style planning, it's that way for a reason. It's probably the best way that it is. A lot of your big corporations have now went to business plans that almost resemble the way the military plans a mission. Because you know what you're going to do. You set multiple plans in place for that to happen. And there's people that they make a living doing nothing but making these operation plans or operation orders in place for corporations or inside that corporation. So they, no matter what happens to them, they've got a backup plan or they've got a different way to go about it. Or if a law changes, we're going to do this. If we get sued, we're going to do this. And then they have business meetings, which are basically after actions review. When they start going through the plan and you're looking at these stages of the plan and you're going, holy cow. And you can break down this after action review is so important, guys, that if you're going out for 2 weeks to get permission like I was doing, I did the same thing. Now, I was trained in this in the military, so I kind of thought about it. Okay, during the day, when I realized, okay, you know, it would have been better if I would have, you know, had their names written down or their permission slips on hand or had better routes planned out. At the end of the 2 weeks, I'd kind of sit down for 10 or 15 minutes and I'd look through the notes from everything I was doing from the getting permission stage and go, well, next year when I go get permissions, I need to have this better planned, that better planned. I need to have this on hand. You know, maybe I need to dress a little different, clean my truck up a little bit more. Whatever it is, when you talk to people and you see responses from them, and then you go, holy cow, if I say kill, it turns them off. So I don't need to use that word anymore. That's part of your after action review. How you do your intro. If you see people start tensing up, start changing it around. And when you start getting one where most people are comfortable with it, then you write that down in your after action review and you use that from then on. You can still change it, but you've got something better to work with. So as you go out and you're thinking about your trapping, think about it in this point of view. And there's a great resource that normally, at least when I was in the military, they only cost $8 or $9. You can get online probably with eBay and things like that. And there's a book out there called The Ranger Handbook. And it's not a very big book, and a lot of it won't apply to you, but it really gets into the meat of having a mission statement, an operations plan, and an after-action review. And if you, that'll give you a guideline that you can go through for $8 or $9. It's a great resource to have. If you're into military-type stuff and you've never read the Ranger Handbook, you'll get a kick out of it because it's a hoot, you know, and you can learn a lot of different things from that. Because if you take your trapping in a military format, a lot of things start happening a whole lot better. Because Murphy's out there, and he's going to try to find some way, somehow, to screw you up. And there's nothing better to me, even though Murphy is a fictional character, even though his actions are very real. If Murphy comes out and I go to put my boat in the water and the wind's blowing 40 miles an hour and it's 6 foot high and it's too dangerous, I know because of my operations plan, all right, screw you, Mr. Murphy, I'm going road trapping. I really don't care what you did to the river, or I'm going to the permissions. And then you just keep rolling on and it's real smooth. And all of a sudden these things that are really, really devastating to a trap line don't seem that bad anymore. Because when plan one fails, you go to plan two, plan three, plan four, and it's no big deal. And you start getting control of your trap line when you do that. And I'm going to use an example right now of how I did not do this myself and plan for a very specific thing that right now has got me in a very grumpy mood this trapping season over the last 2 weeks. I've got written down, I've got a notebook every year, and I've got one for the last, I don't know, probably 12 years of my trap line where I write all this down. I've got notes everywhere in there. I look at it before I start planning for the next season. I didn't plan this year for my lure sales to be as high as they are. So what did Mr. Murphy bring me by not planning ahead this year? For the last 10 days, I've had to spend more time in the lure shop than I did on the trap line. And that's put me in a very bad mood. So what am I going to do next year? I'm already working mentally through a plan so this doesn't happen to me next year. Because what I did this year, when Charles Dobbins talked about trappers catching themselves in traps because they wanted to have something on the market, this is the first time the traps ever closed on me like it has this year. I'm grateful for the sales. I'm grateful guys are buying it and having good luck with it. But I didn't have in my operations plan ahead of time to be able to deal with this. So I'm not getting the trap the last 10 days like I normally get to this time of year because I didn't plan for the lure sales to be where they are right now. That's my fault. It's not going to happen again, I promise you that. Because on my after action review, I'm going to kick myself in the teeth for not having that planned, and you can bet your bottom dollar next year it'll be worked out. You know, if you're not a lure maker, you may think, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me. Yeah, it does, because it could be something to do with your job, vacation. Your wife pulls something out of the hat like she did to me 2 years ago, I think, and scheduled a cruise 3 days after the season opened because I didn't think she'd actually schedule it. There's always going to be stuff out there that's going to try to slow you down. It's your job to have plan B. Next, I'm going to talk a little bit about dog-proof traps. Before I do that, I've got a little a joke I want to tell everybody. And this is a pretty serious joke in one way. And I want you to think about it because of what's going to be happening in 2012. And this is so true. And humor can do this a lot of times to put things in perspective. And this is a political joke, so I'm just warning you. And it's not about Republicans or Democrats or anything like that. But it's so true to what I think most people are being so suckered into the political system that I think you'll get a kick out of this. Well, there was a senator, a corrupt one, of course, that was tragically hit by a car and died one day. So he arrives at the pearly gates and sees St. Peter. St. Peter says, "Welcome to heaven. Before you settle in, it seems like we have a problem. We seldom see high officials like yourself in these parts. We're not sure what to do with you." Senator says, "No problem. Just let me in." "Well, I'd like to, but I have orders from the higher up, so we have to let you spend one day in heaven and one day in hell. Then we'll let you choose where you want to be." Senator goes, "Really? Well, I've already made my mind up. I want to be in heaven." St. Peter says, "I'm sorry, but we have rules. And you got to pick between heaven and hell, and you get one day to decide." So the senator kind of shrugs his shoulders, thinking this is a non-brainer. St. Peter escorts him to an elevator. Down, down, down they go. When the doors open, he finds himself on a big, lush golf course. All his buddies are there. His friends from college are there. Gorgeous girls are in scanty clothes everywhere. They play a nice round of golf. They feast on lobster and caviar and champagne that night. There's fires. They tell stories. It's one of the best times he has ever had in his life. Once he starts to go to bed and he wakes up, St. Peter comes and gets him. They get back in the elevator and they go up, up, and up. They open the doors. They're in heaven. He gets 24 hours of his time in heaven. He's up he's going from cloud to cloud with everybody else in heaven, and they're playing harps and they're singing, and everybody's peaceful and everything's going on, and he has a pretty good time. After that 24 hours is up, St. Peter's comes and gets him and says, "Well, where do you want to go?" And the senator thinks about it and he goes, "Well, it was pretty fun, but pretty boring up here in heaven. I think I enjoyed hell a lot better, so I want to spend my time in hell." St. Peter takes him to the elevator and sends him down. Down he goes. After a few minutes, the doors open, and lo and behold, it looks like he's in Mojave Desert. There's not a green thing anywhere. It's smoking hot. He starts sweating. He looks around at all his friends that were there playing golf yesterday. They're in tattered clothes. And they're picking up trash that just keeps falling out of the sky like snow. And there's guys behind them with whips. And they're striking on them if they start slowing down. There's nothing to eat there but water and bread. And he's just in total shock. Well, the devil, which was so nice to him the day before, comes up and puts his arm around him. He said, "Welcome to hell. You made a very good decision, my friend." And the senator doesn't know what to say. So he looks up at the devil and he goes, "What is going on? There was a golf course here with beautiful women. All my friends were having a good time. We had lobster and caviar and drank the best champagnes." And the devil kind of looked at him and grinned. He said, "Yesterday was campaigning. Today you voted." Let that sink in to everybody. Right now, what you're hearing at these debates, what all these people are promising you, what both parties are saying they're going to do, this is campaign season. Everything's good. Everything's lush. When you vote, all that's over with. So make your mind up about what you really want in the long term, because you're going to be stuck with it. And when the campaign season's over with, guys, it's over. Well, Let's talk a little bit about dog-proof traps now. Pet-proof traps, whatever you want to call them. There's a lot of different ones on the market, and I'm not going to use this as a commercial base for the Alcatraz or anything like that. I just want to talk about some of the basics, because I know there's a lot of guys, from the volume of traffic that this radio show is going out to people, I know there's a lot of guys from emails that are just getting into the dog-proof trap thing and they're having some problems with them. So I want to go over just quickly, if you're new to the dog-proofs or you've been using them a while, maybe some things you ought to be thinking about with them. Now, the dog-proof trap has really came onto its own in about the last 5 or 6 years. The granddaddy, the beginning of what I consider the modern dog-proof traps that we have today is a little Grizz out of Missouri. Very good trap. Expensive trap, but it's a good trap. And that was the first trap that in mass allowed people to go out and take coon in numbers with a dog-proof style trap. You didn't have to take it apart. You didn't have to move stuff around after you caught an animal. You didn't have to have tools with you. Stuff like that is pretty much stabbing the ground and go. And it really changed the face of a lot of the coon trapping that we see along today. The problem with that is a lot of guys are trying to combine foothold trapping with DP trapping in the way that they're trying to present the trap. And that's gonna really get a lot of guys in trouble. And if you're thinking, well, I go set a dirt hole out in the corner of a field and I catch a raccoon, or I just set one on along the side of the road because I see coon tracks there sometimes, and I catch a raccoon in some footholds, then it's going to work the same on the DP. And I'm telling you, it's not. I don't know why it doesn't. I really don't understand that. And I went through this same thing when I started using the dog-proof traps. When you're thinking of your dog-proof traps, you have to think of them in the terms of a snare or a conibear, which means you've got to have that in a situation where the coon is literally going to have to walk over or right next to the trap. And if you don't do that, the raccoons, for the most part, seem to ignore the dog-proof traps. And it doesn't matter what make, model, shape, or whatever you have or what you've got in there. If it's not on the actual travel way of the coon, you want the dog-proof trap where when they're coming down the trail, just like you were going to use a snare or conibear, and they're going to go through your trap. You want them, if they're not paying attention, they're daydreaming about their sweetheart somewhere, that they actually knock their nose on your trap. Worst case, you can put that to the side of the trail or maybe a couple of feet off the trail, but make it very obvious and a lot of odor around it. But you've got to have that trap on the travel way. Setting it out on a sandbar by itself, probably not going to be as effective as going to where that sandbar starts hooking back up with the bank and it forces the coon to be right there. That's where you want to put the trap. Putting it out in the corner of a field or in coyote or fox type locations, even though you catch raccoons there, it's probably not going to be the best thing for you when you're using these dog-proof traps. When you're setting these traps, I want to tell you a little bit about some interesting stuff I've seen on some night vision footage that really opens your eyes about a lot of the sprung traps people get. If you're in an area that has possums, there's a good chance possums are what's causing your traps to fire off. But everybody, when you set a dog-proof trap for a raccoon, you're thinking coon. Just like when a coyote trapper sets a coyote trap, he's thinking a coyote's digging his trap bed out because he's thinking coyotes, even though a coon or fox or skunk probably did it, because that's in the back of your mind, is that you're thinking about coyotes. Same thing goes on with the dog-proof traps. Possums, for some reason, and I can't get one of them to tell me what the reason is yet, but I keep asking them, when they come up to a dog-proof trap, when there's lure inside and it's sticking up out of the ground, the way most of them are done today, for some reason, the first thing a possum does is he uses it as a back and side scratcher. And he'll go around and he'll just scratch and roll. And I mean, it's like he's been waiting to find a back scratcher his whole life. And he's pushing up against it and you'll see the trap kind of rock around a little bit. And he goes around the sides of that. Well, most traps, no matter what you use, has something on the outside of the tube that the bait's in that you catch the animal with. And I've seen this on all forms of traps. I haven't done it with the Dukes or the Daggers, but since they have the same features and hardware on the outside, I know it's going to be the same for them. But on the little Grizzes, when I first started seeing this, I thought, well, maybe I was using something in there that was making them want to scratch or roll, and they couldn't because it was in the tube. But it really didn't matter what I put in there. What's happening to a lot of guys, when you come up to a trap and it's fired off in place, the possum comes up and he starts using it as a scratching post, and he's rubbing it up against the dog, like on a little Grizz or the trigger mechanism, and then it'll fire the trap. Well, there's nothing in the trap to catch because the possum's on the outside and he's rubbing up against the trap, and it fires. On the Alcatraz, we've got the setting rod on one side, and if you set the trap up and down and the possum comes up and does the scratch post thing to you, he's probably going to fire the trap off sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. So what do we do about it? We see the problem. Possum's rubbing up against it and he's firing it off. Whether you use a Grizz, a Duke, a Dagger, I know there's some other traps out there, I just don't know what their names are, Alcatraz, whatever that is, since we know from night vision footage, or if you didn't know, you're learning about it now, that a possum's going to go up and scratch and roll and do all that stuff up next to the trap, and he can fire off traps by doing that. Whatever trap you're using, if you're using an Alcatraz and you've got that rod on the bottom that you set it with, instead of putting the trap straight up and down, put it on a 45-degree angle where that's facing the ground. If you're using a Duke or a Grizz or a Dagger, the hardware on the outside that you're setting where the dog and trigger are, that's holding the spring open so the coon can go down and get the bait, set that on the very bottom of set that on a 45.2 degrees, so when the possum comes up and he starts scratching on all these traps, he's not actually going to be able to easily rub up against the firing mechanism or any hardware that's coming out of that tube, and that'll save you a tremendous amount of heartache and scratching your head, because you can get very frustrated with equipment if you just assume you know what's going on with the trap. Because if you're thinking about coon and you're just getting started with a dog-proof traps and you're in a high possum population area and you go up there and you see the traps just fired in place, you're going to start not believing in the trap that you're using. The trap had nothing to do with it. The possum is the reason it was doing it. And you may, okay, well, maybe the bait's not working. This isn't working. My location, no, the possum's doing it. He's up there and he's scratching around with that thing. Also, with some raccoons, they'll fiddle fart around with that trap if it's sticking straight up in the air. And a raccoon doesn't know that the smooth side of that trap's safe to touch and the other side doesn't. I've got footage with little Grizzes, and it wouldn't matter what type of trap it is. This isn't a trap bashing session by any stretch, because a lot of good traps on the market. If he grabs that trigger or that dog and starts fiddling around with it, the trap's going to throw. On the Alcatraz, if he grabs that rod, the trap's going to throw. So if you put it in a position where it's harder for him to do that, and if you're seeing a lot of traps that are sprung, even when you're putting it on a 45-degree angle, mound up some dirt right there, as long as you're not in real freezing-type temperatures, or some leaves or some debris right there at the front and just kind of pressured up under the trap, not where it's going to keep the trap from functioning, but where it's going to make it harder for the coon or the possum to set the thing off. And then you're going to have more of a chance for him not playing with the outside and going to the inside. The other thing about dog-proof traps that you'll learn over time, and a lot of people have different methods for doing this, is even though you've got something really good in that trap, because it's in that tube, for whatever reason, some coons just don't pay attention to it. A lot of coons are gluttons and they'll stop and do things because of the odor. That's why you see a lot of guys going to a fish oil or some type of anise type base or cherry or something, where they'll spray around, make a ring around that trap to get the coon to stop and start piddling around, then he's going to be at the trap in the center of it. I think that's a good thing to do for anybody. You can use any type of oils you want or whatever, as long as it's edible and something that's going to be good. Some people are using fish meal and the dehydrated molasses. But you want to give him something there outside of the trap that he doesn't have to work for to kind of get him in the mood a little bit. You can use marshmallows, except, you know, squirrels, deer, possums, skunks, everything else really likes the marshmallows too. What I like to do is give them a teaser bait on the lip of the trap. I want to, if I can, give them some smell around the trap to really get their attention before they blow past the thing, especially late in the year when they're thinking about sex. Get them to slow down, and then whatever the bait is, you want to make sure it's something that's edible. You put a little bit of it right on the lip of the trap. Now, every trap's going to be a little different. When you set the trap, you'll see however the tube is covered in one form or another, and there's a way to either put a little piece of dog food or a small marshmallow or a piece of candy or coon crush or something right there so that when the coon comes up, he don't have to exert any effort. He gets to taste the bait. This is really good. And then all of a sudden he's going to go, I want some more bait. And down in this little tube, there's some more of it. And he reaches down there and starts piddling with a trap. And hopefully you catch him. That'll really help a lot of guys having refusals on their little grizzlies. Just because, and it's for some reason, this is, they're so different from a foothold trap as far as using the dirt and the hole and all that to really get a coon's attention. By giving him that teaser bait, just like you do at a cage trap where you put some marshmallows out front or something like that, or crawfish for otter, when you give him that little bit of teaser bait right on the lip of that trap, it seems to really improve them going into the trap and getting caught. Later in the year, like we're at right now where it's January, and the rut's starting to really, really be in high gear, one of the biggest things, and it's not really that uncommon anymore, but if you're new to dog-proof traps, this time of year, the raccoons are going from denning area to denning area. And they are really interested in animal smells at that time. Now, you can use a gland lure or urine. I recommend the gland lure because, to me, it lasts longer and it gives more of a true animal smell. It seems to turn the raccoons on better. Earlier in the year, early November, a lot of food sources out. It's not as important. When you get closer to the rut, it does seem to be a lot more important. You don't want to put your urine or your gland lure, in my opinion, down in the trap. They're not going to want to eat it. You're just wanting to stop them because there's a lot of coons out this time of year, even though if it's cold and snow and ice and all that good stuff, because Randy Smith now is probably already over 1,000 raccoons already, and he didn't really start till it started freezing up in a lot of his trap lines. But by using a gland lure, whether it be coyote, coon, fox, cat, mink, it doesn't really matter. But you want to, what I do is I smear that right on the side of that trap, right on the very side of it. So that way the body odor is going to get the male's attention. And once you slow him down, then the food part of it will take over and you can work, he'll work the trap and get caught that way. But that's just some of the tips I wanted to go over on the dog-proof traps that I think will help. Before we go, I want to differentiate two things between the Alcatraz and the other traps because they're very important. On the Duke, the Grizz, the Dagger, they're using a rod trigger. No matter if it's push, pull, circle, whatever they're doing, it's a rod trigger. On those style type traps, you need to put a lot of bait in those traps. Because a raccoon, if you've seen Teachers of the Night, can be in and out of that thing several times before or if he gets caught. Just by the way the triggering mechanism is. Now, if you're relying on that push-pull theory, and you give enough bait in there to stop the losses, and you've got bait slam up to the trigger, is it really a push and pull trigger at that point if it can't go down? You know, that's something to think about. Is the money really worth it there? Could be. I don't know. You know, you could be using more of a softer type bait that they can push through and it's not going to freeze. You know, you just need to think about these type things. But the rod style triggers that we're used to seeing in a lot of the other traps, you have to give them enough bait to go back in it several times to get caught. No matter what the manufacturers say, that's just the way it is. Now on the Alcatraz, we use a push pan type system where they've got to try to go around the pan, which is what catches them, to get caught. Now the opposite is true on the Alcatraz. Because we've made it hard for them to get in there to get to the bait, you don't want to feel the bait all the way up to the door, because it is a push system. It's designed, when the coon goes around the pan, he gets caught. And if you feel that thing all the way up to the pan, just like the push-pull triggers are, they're being pushed now on the market for the grizz-style traps. If the bait's all the way up to it and packed in there, it can't go down. Therefore, you're not going to catch the coon. So you don't want to fill an Alcatraz all the way up to the pan. You can get away with a lot more lure-type stuff in an Alcatraz than you can in a grizz-style trap, just because of that one difference. The other thing is the type of bait you put in the Alcatraz is a lot different than you put in a trigger rod system that's in a grizz style trap. And the reasons are very simple. Whatever trap you use, you just have to understand how to use it, or you're not going to get the best results out of it. On a grizz style trap, people are using marshmallows, pieces of large candy, huge gummy bears. They're putting in toothpicks and crossing underneath that rod. Some guys have actually been so tired of their bait being stolen, they're making wire mesh screens that they can put over the bait, so the coon's got to pull the screen out, which hopefully fires the trap before you can even get to the bait. So you can use big, blocky type stuff, because if the coon grabs your bait in a grizz style trap, you want him to be able to fire the trap as he's trying to bring the bait around your trigger. Now on the Alcatraz, on the other hand, that style of trap with that big retention pan in there, you don't want to give him a big blocky thing like a marshmallow. So if it's all the way up against the pan and he hooks a toenail in there, he's pulling that out of the way of the part that's going to catch him, and you're going to get a lot of toe caught coon that way. So just be sure of why you're doing what you're doing to the trap that you're using. Both of them are good traps. They're just different. And if you try to do one system to the other trap, you're going to get frustrated with the other trap. Because if you try to load up an Alcatraz, you're not going to have the same results you do in a little grizz. And if you don't load up a little grizz style trap like you do with an Alcatraz, you're not going to have very good luck with the little grizz. They're just totally different catching platforms, and you have to know how to use them. So keep that in mind as you're going out to use them. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. Don't waste this season, guys. It's getting shorter and shorter, and before long, we'll be complaining about how hot it is and waiting for the next season to come. Even if you can only run a very short line, like I'm having to do right now while I'm working on my lures, go out and enjoy it. Try to learn something a little bit from it. Be a better trapper today than you were yesterday. And I'll see you next week on Trapping Across America.